This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guest tonight is Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz, who is here from New York. Schultz is the author of several collections of poetry, including Failure, winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize, and his latest book, The God of Loneliness, Selected and New Poems. Schultz is the founder and director of the Writer's Studio in New York City and right here in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We'll get to some poems in Failure in just a little bit, but first, I can't help noticing the irony of a book with this title, Failure, winning the Pulitzer Prize. Is this brought up to you all the time?
Yes. Actually, when I was trying to find a title for the book, and it's about my father's failure, of course, you wouldn't feel as if you inherit that, so it became a legacy, but I asked friends, poet friends, how they liked the title, and they all to a one did not like it. They said, well, you're going to be feeding ammunition to your critics, and how can you call a book Failure? Who's going to buy a book Failure? And it was just one friend, an English friend, who said, I guess because he had some distance on the subject, he said, that's the great American taboo, James Lasden, the poet and fiction writer. He said, that's the perfect title. And so I went with that.
Your latest book, The God of Loneliness, Selected in New Poems, is peopled with such interesting characters that although there is no doubt that these are poems, the book almost reads like a braided novella in verse.
And I love hearing that. No one's ever said that to me. You know, I tried to write fiction, and I went to Iowa in fiction, and there was, I'm a storyteller, and I love storytelling. Thank you. And but the poetic form was the one that worked for me and compressing. And so when you put a selected together, you have no idea what you're really going to come away with. You're taking parts of your life, a history of your life, and people, the man who wrote these parts is now a stranger to me. You have no idea what the story is going to tell or if there is a story. So hearing about all these different characters is really music to my ears.
Graded because some of the stories the poems tell, not the poems themselves, are revisited as we move forward in the book. For instance, your father's death, other family members, and your guardian angel, Stein, also make appearances and reappearances. Was it a need to preserve the memory of these people that more than anything else pointed you in the direction of writing poetry?
Yes. I wanted to, I mean, one book is a long sequence, which is a kind of novel in verse, living in the past, in which I try to preserve the lost world of my youth, where a street of immigrants suddenly was overwhelmed by a wave of displaced persons from the camps who were never accepted by the neighborhood, and it was one layer too heavy to bear. And trying to live through that. I wanted to capture that.
Before we get to all of these various characters in the book, I think it's appropriate to ask you to read a poem from the first book in this collection, Like Wings, which was published in 1978. The poem is San Francisco Remembered.
Well, I feel as if San Francisco is my home. I mean, I was here as a teen. I came as 19, and I, it was very significant years. And I recall this poem, which I haven't read for a very long time, and then I was trying later to write about those early years, and I thought I was going to write about the city, and another subject kept intervening. Okay. San Francisco Remembered. In summer, the polleny light bounces off the white buildings, and you can see their spines and nerves and where the joints knot. You've never seen such polleny light. The whole city shining and the women wearing dresses so thin you see their wing-tipped hips and their tall silvery legs alone could knock your eye out. But this isn't about women. It's about the city of blue waters and fog so thick it wraps round your legs and leaves glistening trails along the dark winding streets. Once I followed such a trail and wound up beside this red-headed woman who looked up and smiled. And let me tell you, You don't see smiles like that in Jersey City. She was wearing a black raincoat with 200 pockets, and I wanted to put my hands in each one, but forget about her. I was talking about the fog, which steps up and taps your shoulder like a panhandler, who wants bus fare to a joint called the Paradise, and where else could this happen? On Sundays, Golden Gate Park is filled with young girls strolling the transplanted palms and imported rhododendron beds. You should see the sunset in their eyes and the sway, the proud sway of their young shoulders. Believe me, it takes a day or two to recover. Or the trolleys clanking down the steep hills. Why, you see legs flashing like mirrors. Please, Lord, please let me talk about San Francisco. How that gorilla of a bridge twists in the ocean wind and the earth turns under your feet. And at any moment, the whole works can crack and slip back into the sea like a giant being kicked off his raft. And now, if it's all right, I would like to talk about women.
That's great. Thank you so much. I
mentioned earlier that the book is teeming with interesting people. I'd like to move on to as many of them as possible. Your father, your mother, your grandmother, your uncle, your guardian angel, Stein. Who is Stein? Is he real or imagined?
People, Yehuda Amichai, the great Israeli writer who was a very dear friend for many years, claimed he was, told people he was. So I actually have a pamphlet, a chapbook called My Guardian Angel Stein, and it's dedicated to him. And he tells people that he was my, and he served as a kind of guardian. I invented, out of necessity, when times were bad, someone to look over me. And it was comforting to me. And he made an appearance in my first book in a long poem. I didn't know who he was and why, you know, as a Jew, why we would have a guardian angel. But there I had one. And, you know, and he kept popping up in other poems. And finally he had his own poem.
Would you read My Guardian Angel Stein?
Okay. My Guardian Angel Stein. In our house, every floor was a wailing wall. In each sideward glance, a history of insult. Nightly, Grandma bolted the doors, believing God had a personal grievance to settle on our heads. Not Atreus, exactly, but we had furies. Uncle Jake banged the table, demanding respect from fate, and enough outrage to impress Aristotle with the prophetic unity of our misfortune. No wonder I hid behind the sofa sketching demons to identify the faces in my dreams and stayed under bathwater until my lungs split like pomegranate seeds. Stein arrived one New Year's Eve fresh from a salvation in Budapest. Nothing in his 6,000 years prepared him for our nightly bacchanal of immigrant indignity except his stint in the Hundred Years' War, where he lost his eyesight and faith both. This myopic angel knew everything about calamity. He taught King David the art of hubris and Moses the price of fame, and quoted Dante to prove others had it worse. On winter nights we memorized the Dead Sea Scrolls until I could sleep without a nightlight, and he explained why the stars appear only at night. Insomniacs, they study the Torah all day. Once I asked him outright, Stein, why is our house so unhappy? Adjusting his rimless glasses, he said, Wojciech, life is a comedy salted with despair. All humans are disappointed. Laugh yourself to sleep each night, and with luck, pluck, and credit cards, you'll beat them at their own game. Catharsis is necessary in this house. Ah, Stein, bless your outsized wings and balding pate. And while I'm at it, why not bless the imagination's lonely fray with time, which, yes, like love and family romance, has neither beginning, middle, nor end.
Let's move right on to Failure, the title poem of your Pulitzer Prize-winning book. It's heartbreaking, but it also has a dash of humor. Your father is such a huge presence in this book. I don't know who wouldn't love your father after reading this poem.
Well, thank you. Let me... First, thank you for saying that. That's a very generous way of looking at it. Failure. To pay for my father's funeral, I borrowed money from people he already owed money to. One called him a nobody. No, I said, he was a failure. You can't remember a nobody's name. That's why they're called nobodies. Failures are unforgettable. The rabbi who read a stock eulogy about a man who didn't belong to or believe in anything was both a failure and a nobody. He failed to imagine the son and wife of the dead man being shamed by each word. To understand that not believing in or belonging to anything demanded a kind of faith and buoyancy. An uncle counting on his fingers my father's business failures, a parking lot that raised geese, a motel that raffled honeymoons, a bowling alley with roving mariachis, failed to love and honor his brother, who showed him how to whistle under covers, steal apples with his right or left hand. Indeed, my father was comical. His watches pinched, he tripped on his pant cuff, and snored loudly in movies where his weariness overcame him finally. He didn't believe in savings, insurance, newspapers, vegetables, good or evil, human frailty, history, or God. Our family avoided us, fearing boils. I left town, but failed to get away.
Did he die of a stroke? He was only 60.
59. A heart attack. He had had a stroke, and his doctor couldn't get him to stop working and go into the hospital and passed that job on to me. My mother wasn't successful at it. So we fought right up to the time where he died and made for not a good leave-taking.
Would you read The One Truth?
May I comment on that? Absolutely. I had lunch with a friend in New York, and we both discovered that our fathers were failures. And we were, first time ever. Sometimes it's hard for men to talk about these things. And he talked about his father, and I talked about mine. And I, on the way home, the one truth started to come. And it led to all the others. It this never happens to me. The whole poem I was reciting, walking home, by the time I got there, I just wrote it down. And 3 days later, I began to write Failure. And then I was putting a book together over less than a year. The One Truth. After dreaming of radiant thrones for 60 years, praying to a God he never loved for strength, for mercy, after cocking his thumbs in the pockets of his immigrant schemes, while he parked cars during the day and drove a taxi all night, after one baby was born dead and he carved the living one's name in windshield snow in the blizzard of 1945, after scrubbing piss, blood, and vomit off factory floors from midnight to dawn, then filling trays with peanuts, candies, and cigarettes in his vending machines all day, his breath a wheezing suck and billowing gasp in the fist of his chest, after washing his face, armpits, and balls in cold back rooms, hurrying between his hunger for glory and his fear of leaving nothing but debt, after having a stroke and falling down factory stairs, his son screaming at him to stop working and rest, after being knocked down by a blow he expected all his life, his son begging forgiveness, his wife crying his name, after looking up at them straight from hell, his soul withering in his arms, is this what failure is, to end where he began? No one but a deaf, dumb God to welcome him back, his fist pounding at the gate. Is this the one truth, to lie in a black pit at the bottom of himself, without enough breath to say goodbye or ask forgiveness?
Thank you so much. We get the idea from some of the poems in this book that your uncle was a troubled man. Would you read From Living in the Past, number 2?
Well, Uncle Jake was quite a character, yes. You could say he had his influence on me. No one in this family ever suspects they're unhappy. In fact, the less happy we are, the less we suspect it. Uncle walks around with a straight-edge razor tied round his neck on a red string, screaming and pounding on things. When he's angry, and he's always angry, he drops to a crouch and screams until the veins in his neck bulge like steam pipes. Mother locks herself, Grandma, and me in the toilet until he's flat. We spend a lot of time in the toilet, never suspecting anything. Didn't everyone on Cuba Place have an uncle who hides in a tiny room off the kitchen, yelling at a police radio and writing letters to dead presidents while reading girly books all night? Didn't everyone live in a house where everyone feels cheated, ignored, and unredeemed?
How did this behavior affect you?
Well, as an only child, I escaped into my imagination. You had to hide. I mean, my uncle's favorite game was I'd go into the bathroom at night. He'd be hiding behind the shoe in the tub and yell "boo," and scare me. And he was ill.
Yeah.
And it was an immigrant family where that first generation tries to make the adjustment. And you know, Darwin has this theory that every species vastly overproduces in order for the minority to adapt and survive. Mm-hmm. And that's what their purpose is, to be sacrificed. And I think the layer of immigrants in this neighborhood, all kinds of people from all religions and all countries, most of them were part of the sacrifice. They didn't adjust. And my generation, the kids were struggling to become Americans and create the American ideal wasn't something that was given to this older generation. They lived in hiding mostly in their identities. The backyards were the gardens of the various countries, Eastern European countries. It was beautiful at spring, but people were trying to recreate the past because the present was too frightening and they couldn't even imagine the future.
Well, you know, it's not as if they came here because they wanted to leave their home. It's, you know, that they wanted to become Americans and speak English. They had to leave so much behind. It had to be so painful.
Well, that's brilliant. You're putting your finger on it. They had to immigrate. They were escaping pogroms and death, and it wasn't a choice. It wasn't anything they understood or wanted to do. You know, I never understood that or said that before you brought this out. Yes, they were trying to recreate the past and comfort themselves with it. They were not interested in moving on. My grandmother spoke Yiddish and four other Russian and Polish, but she wouldn't learn English, and all her friends wouldn't learn English. They didn't want to move on.
Your grandmother also figures very prominently in this book. She's your grandmother, but her voice is very familiar to us. Would you read Ode?
Well, these are some of my favorite poems. I'm really glad you're asking me to read it. She's a real player in the long book, Living in the Past, so I never read Ode because I think, oh my God, it's too much already. But, you know, that is a poem that she made her first appearance, really, in my work in this one. Grandma stuffed her fur coat into the icebox. God himself couldn't convince her it wasn't a closet. God take me away this minute was her favorite Friday night prayer. Nothing made sense, she said. Expect heartburn and bad teeth, not sense. Leave a meat fork in a dairy dish, and she'd break the dish and bury the fork. I spit on this house, on this earth, and on God for putting me in this life that spits on me night and day, she cried, forgetting the barley and barley soup. It wasn't age. She believed she was put here to make one unforgivable mistake after another. Thou shalt be disappointed, was God's first law. Her last words were, turn off the stove before the house blows up. Listen, I'm 34 already, and nothing I do is done well enough. But what if disappointment is faith and not fate? What if we never wanted anything enough to hurt over? All I can say is spring came this year with such a wallop, the trees are still shaking. Grandma, what do we want from them? What do we want?
Good question at the end of that poem. I mentioned other people who are not members of your family, the guardian angel Stein. Another one is Mr. Schwartzman. Was he your piano teacher?
You mean the real one? Well, there was a Mr. Schwartzman who lived in his sister's boarding house, who was one of the wave of DPs who came to live on the street, who had had a terrible dark past. And I knew Yiddish from my grandmother. That's the only way I could talk to her. So I translated his letters and to his son and whatever. And I later found out that no one survived. I was writing letters for him to the dead. And he never made the transition to the street. And he didn't teach me. In reality, he didn't teach me piano. He was a violinist, and I suspect from my grandmother, he was a highly accomplished musician. But he never went back to music. He just sat on the porch and read the Bible.
I see. Well, would you please read this lovely poem? It's also from Living in the Past. It's number 10 in that section.
Almost every night, Mr. Schwartzman wakes up Spinoza calm in a pit named Auschwitz, opens his Lazarus eyes wide, and looks around at the dead eyeballs, broken fingers, and mouth stuffed with screams. His teeth tick, his kneecaps scrape, his nose big as a blood sausage. For piano lessons, I write his letters nobody answers, about Mrs. Tillum's boarding house, where everyone stinks of herring and moans in their sleep, about his job at the A&P providing for everyone else's appetite. Not about what happened to his music or why God spared him. Saturday mornings for 2 years he speaks Yiddish as I write my 12-year-old English until the day I find him hanging in his closet with a note pinned to his tie. One does not perish among Jews.
Thank you. Did you actually find him?
No.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
It just happened in the story. It just, there was someone else, a neighbor of his across the hall, who I didn't find him, but he was found hanging. And I transposed that into to Mr. Schwartzman. And very few of these people made it, survived the transition. They walked back and forth in their long black coats, back and forth like figures in a assembly line, like in a clock.
I want to note at this point that all of the poems you're reading tonight are from various collections, but they all appear in this newest book, The God of Loneliness. I want to make sure we have time for the title poem, so why don't you go ahead now and read The God of Loneliness.
Happy to. The God of Loneliness. It's a cold Sunday, February morning, and I'm one of 8 men waiting for the doors of Toys R Us to open in a mall on the eastern tip of Long Island. We've come for the Japanese electronic game that's so hard to find. Last week, I waited 3 hours for a store in Manhattan to disappoint me. The first today, bundled in 6 layers, I stood shivering in the dawn light, reading the new Aeneid translation, which I hid when the others came, stamping boots and rubbing gloveless hands, joking about sacrificing sleep for ungrateful sons. My boy broke 2 front teeth playing hockey, a man wearing shorts laughs. This is his reward. My sons will leap into my arms, remembering this morning all their lives. The game is for my oldest boy, just back from Iraq, a man in overalls says from the back of the line. He plays these games in his room all day. I'm not worried. He'll snap out of it. He's earned his rest. These men fix leaks, lay foundations for other men's dreams without complaint. They've been waiting in the cold since Aeneas founded Rome on rivers of blood. Virgil understood that death begins and never ends, that it's the god of loneliness. Through the window, a clerk shouts, "We have only 5. The others seem not to know what to do with their hands, Tuck them under their arms or let them hang naked and useless. Is it because our hands remember what they held, the promises they made? I know exactly when my boys will be old enough for war. Soon three of us will wait across the street at Target, because it's what men do for their sons.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
This is Catherine Hastings. My guest has been Philip Schultz, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet of failure. Tonight he has been reading from his latest collection, The God of Loneliness, Selected and New Poems, published this year. If you'd like more information about his book, you can go to hmhbooks.com or pop me an email. There is more poetry coming up, but first, here's Hoagie Carmichael singing Stardust.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely night dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you when our love was new. And each kiss an inspiration. Oh, but that was long ago. Now my consolation is in the stardust of a song beside a garden wall. When stars are bright, you are in my arms. The nightingale tells his fairy tale of paradise where roses grew, though I dream in vain. In my heart it will remain, my stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain. Stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. If you were to visit a certain cherry tree on the Swarthmore campus in Pennsylvania, you would notice a plaque beneath it that reads, "I have stood so long in this place, I have lost account of my face. I have stared so long at this tree, I am grown blossomy. In my branches, words bicker like birds." This transformational poem, Myself, was written by the then 19-year-old Elizabeth McFarland, the late wife of former U.S. Poet Laureate Daniel Hoffman. There are two reasons why I want to shine a little light on Elizabeth McFarland. The first has to do with the importance of her career as poetry editor of the Ladies' Home Journal from 1948 to 1961. You may think with a name like the Ladies' Home Journal that the magazine held no importance to poetry or to poets, but this opinion couldn't be any further from the truth. During the time she served as poetry editor, McFarland brought 6 million readers new poems by the likes of Auden, Marianne Moore, Theodore Retke, Richard Eberhardt, and other prominent poets. In addition, she published poets who weren't well known at that time: Sylvia Plath, Audrian Rich, Donald Hall, Maxine Cumin, Galway Cannell, William Stafford, John Updike, and others. While journals such as Vanity Fair, Harper's Bazaar, and Mademoiselle published fiction by leading authors, the Ladies' Home Journal included 6 to 10 poems each month. Who, since then, has fed the flames of literary culture on this scale? No one, I think. Not only did she see that 6 million readers were given the opportunity to read these poets, the poets were actually paid real money, probably the most generous payments they had ever received for their work. Marianne Moore, for instance, received a check for $362.60 for one 29-line poem. As inflation goes, the check now would be worth well over $2,500. In 1958, Moore received a check for another poem in the Public Garden for $775, the equivalent of over $5,000 today. About 1,000 submissions were delivered to Elizabeth McFarland every single week. She read every one of those poems, whether they were sent by well-known poets or not. Following is a small section of an essay written by Daniel Hoffman, a poet who brought poetry to the millions. One day, while in the office on Independence Square, Liz was called on by half a dozen grim-visaged men in uniform. The American Legion had convened in Philadelphia, and these members demanded to see the poetry editor, who had turned down a contribution by the wife of one of their number. They'd come to object and to threaten. If she didn't agree to publish the patriotic verse of Mrs. Legionnaire, they would insist at the convention that all members' wives cancel subscriptions to such an un-American magazine. During the McCarthy hysteria and the prominence of the John Birch Society, this threat had to be taken seriously. Liz looked at the page again, scanning its hyper-patriotic ejaculations, then said that while its sentiments did credit to the writer, she couldn't publish this in a conservative American family magazine. The Ladies' Home Journal, she told them, represented core American values, and this statement that neither rhymed nor scanned and had no stanzas but was written in lines of all different lengths would, to the journal's readers, look foreign. Taken aback, the Legionnaires grumblingly headed for the elevator. Liz earned her keep that day, protecting the LHJ from thousands of cancellations. Some time after Edna St. Vincent Millay died, her sister Norma came upon a poem in her hand that didn't turn up in any of her books. Thinking to place this find before the millions who'd read it in the LHJ, she bypassed the poetry editor and sent it directly to the top of the masthead, Bruce Gould. Of course, he shared his excitement with Liz, but it was short-lived, for she immediately recognized that Millay had hand-copied a poem from Robert Louis Stevenson's A Child's Garden of Verses, and so saved the journal from becoming the jape of the cognoscenti. Elizabeth McFarland was a poet herself, which brings me to the second reason I want to bring her to your attention. The essay I just read appears at the beginning of a collection of her poems, Over the Summer Water. The poems were published after her death in 2005 and were chosen and arranged by Daniel Hoffman. Their style reflects what Hoffman calls her romantic imagination, her love with sounds of the language, and commitment to intensifying feeling through indirection, subtleties, and surprises of metaphor. These poems should please you, especially those of you with any interest in formal poetry. Sonoma County poet and educator Hannah Maggiore will now read a number of poems from Over the Summer Water by Elizabeth McFarland.
The Acrobatic Heart. That thin, taut girl, injected by the spring, moves in a circus swirl of leaf and song. The wind's the airy string she dances on, and all her poise is tight umbrellas swung. She does not know the winds become her weather, but thinks these tilting days with youth will pass. One might break all his heart and mind together, imagining some peace for her at last. The Rejection. I saw how beautiful your mansions are, your lakes and valleys and your peopled plain, but thought of all that loss with all that gain, and one geography is not enough. One world to loose the spirit in, will not contain a continental ghost. I have a dream of islands drunk and lost, of cities shining with a ripe decay, where old ships feed about their harbor's knees, far, far beyond your small and private seas. Red is the green. Red is the green of my delight, a scarlet red, a gold, like sun-scorched palanquins, a light with lacquer Buddhist old. I choose a red that swells the sight, a red that shakes the heart. I know its meaning in the night. We do not sleep apart. Two voices. He. When we were young, old talk pleased best. Immortality, fate, the will, or the state, and the high thinking rest. Now all that's past, and I ponder late one theme. How young are the wild apples hung high on time's breast. She. Sir, those long walks, when we two strayed deep in the briars of philosophy's glade, to rest at last on sweet moss stone, those talks were abstract for you alone. My words were curved, and all my wit sprang from your heart and aimed at it. Mother Song. I sing of all forsaken things, torn twigs, rent clouds, disheveled wings, brown leaves adrift on autumn's floor, and letters yellowing in a drawer. The worm evicted from the rind, the lamp that in the wind goes blind. I sing of dreams and treasures lost, of all young hope that braves the frost, stars locked behind embedded skies, and little lonely children's cries. I sing the mother song of years to lull the world and dry its tears. Elegy for Donald McFarland. Forgetting you would be myself forgotten, lost in a wave wash, in the seaweed passes, drifting through earth, an anchorage for grasses with icicles, the nails that bolt my tomb. Forgetting you? Oh, when I have forgotten, it's others' minds must worry to recall my leaves, my grass, my seaweed hair, and all. Death shall remember me when I forget you. Reminders. The day I die may not dawn fair, but later, afternoon will clear. A gawky breeze, say south-southwest, will hesitantly touch your face. And where you go to choose my grave, flowers will lie all night for love. Mosses and stones, thin-fingered twigs, leaves with the sun ablaze in their ribs, and the soft, inconsequential rain. And so I'll not leave you alone. over the summer water. Summer distances do not alarm when water fills them. The eye drinks, feels no harm, rinses, and spills them, while the heart, little red canoe, over the resonant river races, calling, "Darling, Clementine, Lou, oh boy in the boater and braces." Summer people, like daguerreotypes, don't fade. They are watermarked, and that is that. Professor and Mrs. Pugh on the Esplanade. Old Mrs. Ferris's hat. The fat boy. The twins. The sophomore. The beau. The bells in their bright boating dresses. Memory wears retrospective clothes, slim waists, and preferably long tresses. Summer quivers over the water on a banjo ping, is magnified and roars to shore. A myriad lost voices in community sing, "Oh, my darling! Oh, Clementine!" No more. For water is ghost freighted with memory. It widens in rings beyond telling, where time's old excursioners go down to sea, their scarves and their bannerets swelling.
That was Hanna Maggiore reading from Over the Summer Water, poems by Elizabeth McFarland. I'm going to take the liberty of reading one more short poem from this lovely book. It's called Speech. When you and I to death are come, I shall speak out, who now am dumb. My unwalled veins, frustrate before, into your body's deeps shall pour. My ashy substance, loosed from flesh, will sift beneath your beauty's mesh, till all my strength lies down unfurled under the long limbs of the world. Elizabeth McFarland. This is Catherine Hastings, and that was Jessica Mulaski singing from her CD Pentimento. And talking about fun, before we move on to more poetry, I want to mention a couple of live events coming up in Sonoma County next month. First of all, the Word Temple Poetry Series is returning on Saturday, July 17th at 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, 6780 Depot Street in Sebastopol. This is Saturday, July 17th. It will be a night of translations. In April of this year, Penguin Classics came out with two new books of poetry by Jorge Luis Borges, The Sonnets and The Poems of the Night. These two collections are the first of a series of five new Borges books to be published by Penguin Classics. The Sonnets is a landmark collection presenting for the first time in any language the complete sonnets of Borges, more than half of which have been translated into English for the first time. Poems of the Night is an intimate revelatory collection of Borges's poetry meditations on nighttime, darkness, and the crepuscular world of visions and dreams. And these books will be presented that evening by poet and translator Stephen Kessler. Also, Stephen Kessler will be presenting Desolation of the Chimera, poems by Luis Cernuda, published by White Pine Press last year. Cernuda was a leading member of Spain's legendary generation of 1927 that included Lorca, Alberti, Buñuel, Dalí, etc. So we have Borges and Cernuda for part of the evening. But that's not all. On the same evening, poets and translators Nguyen Do and Paul Hoover will be presenting their book Beyond the Court Gate, Selected Poems of Nguyen Trai, who lived from 1318 to 1422. You all will remember Paul Hoover from Word Temple when he read from his Selected Poems of Friedrich Hölderlin. He won a major translation prize for that book. The other translator of Beyond the Court Gate, Nguyen Do, writes and translates poetry in Vietnamese and English. He was born in Ha Tinh province of Vietnam and moved to Hanoi as a youth. So on Saturday, July 17th at 7 p.m. at the Word Temple Poetry Series Sebastopol Center for the Arts, we have Borges, Cernuda, and Nguyen Trai. Many thanks to Stephen Kessler, Paul Hoover, and Nguyen Do. For more information, you can go to wordtemple.com or contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Another event happening in July takes place at the Phoenix Theater in Petaluma on July 30th at 7 p.m. You may remember an interview I had on this show with Michael Rothenberg prior to a cross-country tour called Rockpile with the poet David Meltzer. They will be performing along with the Rabbles at the Phoenix Theater on July 30th for a night of poetry, power pop, and crusty rock songs. This is a benefit for the Petaluma Poetry Walk. Admission is on a sliding scale from $5 to $15. For more information on the Rockpile tour, you can go to bigbridge.org/rockpile. Okay, let's return now for a little more poetry. Here is Gwendolyn Brooks.
Obituary for a Living Lady. My friend was decently wild as a child, and as a young girl, she was interested in a brooch and pink powder and a curl. As a young woman, though, she fell in love with a man who didn't know that even if she wouldn't let him touch her breasts, she was still worth his hours, stopped calling Sundays with flowers. Sunday after Sunday, she put on her clean, gay, though white, dress, worried the windows. There was so much silence, she finally decided that the next time she would say yes. But the man had found by then a woman who dressed in red. My friend spent 100 weeks or so wishing she were dead. But crying for yourself when you give it all of your time gets tedious after a while. Therefore, she terminated her mourning, made for her mouth a sad, sweet smile, and discovered the country of God. Now she will not dance, and she thinks not the thinnest thought of any type of romance. And I can't get her to take a touch of the best cream cologne. However, even without lipstick, she is lovely, and it is no wonder that the preacher, at present, is almost a synonym for her telephone, and watches the neutral, kind, bland eyes that moisten the first pew center on Sunday, I beg your pardon, Sabbath nights, and wonders, as his stomach breaks up into fire and lights, how long it will be before he can, with reasonably slight risk of rebuke, put his hand on her knee. Leaves from a loose-leaf war diary. Thousands killed in action. You need the untranslatable ice to watch. You need to loiter a little among the vague hushes, the clever evasions of the vagueness above the healthy energy of decay. You need the untranslatable ice to watch, the purple and black to smell, before your horror can be sweet or proper, before your grief is other than discreet. The intellectual dam will nurse your half-hurt. Quickly you are well, but weary. How you yawn, have yet to see why nothing exhausts you like this sympathy. The certainty we two shall meet by God in a wide parlor underneath a light of lights come sometime is no ointment now, because we two are worshipers of life, being young, being masters of the long-legged stride, gypsy arm swing. We never did learn how to find white in the Bible. We want nights of vague adventure, lips lax wet and warm, bees in the stomach, sweat across the brow, now. The rites for Cousin Vit. Carried her unprotesting out the door. Kicked back the casket stand. But it can't hold her. That stuff and satin aiming to enfold her. The lid's contrition nor the bolts before. Oh, oh, too much, too much. Even Nell surmise. She rises in the sunshine. There she goes, back to the bar she knew, and the repose in love rooms and the things in people's eyes. Too vital and too squeaking, must emerge. Even now she does the snake hips with a hiss, slops the bad wine across her shantung, talks of pregnancy, guitars and bridge work, walks in parks or alleys, comes haply on the verge of happiness, haply hysterics. Is. The Ghost at the Quincy Club. All filmy down she drifts in filmy stuffs and all. Some gentle Gentile girl wafts down our Quincy Hall. This was a mansion once with polished panels and all, where velvet voices lessened, stopped, and rose. Rise raucous howdies, and a curse comes pure. Yea, it comes pure and challenges again all ghost heirs, graces, all daughters of gentlemen, moth soft, off sweet, demure. Where tea and father were, each clear and lemony, our dark folk drinking beer. The Bean Eaters. They eat beans mostly, this old yellow pair. Dinner is a casual affair. Plain chipware on a plain and creaking wood. Tin flatware. Two who are mostly good. Two who have lived their day, but keep on putting on their clothes and putting things away. And remembering with twinklings and twinges, as they lean over the beans in their rented back room that is full of beads and receipts and dolls and cloths, tobacco crumbs, vases, and fringes.
There's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather, since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather, just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time, the time. So weary all the time. When he went away, the blues walked in and met me. If he stays away, old rocking chair will get me. All I do is pray the Lord above will let me walk in the sun once more. Can't go on. All I have in life is gone. Stormy weather, since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Keeps raining all the time. I walk around heavy hearted and sad. Night comes around and I'm still feeling bad. Rain pouring down, blinding every hope I had. This pittering, pattering, beating and spattering drives me mad. Love, 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 love. This misery is just too much for me. Can't go on. Everything I had is gone. Stormy weather, since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Keeps raining all the time.
And that, of course, was the wonderful late Lena Horne, who passed away just last month. If you don't know about that woman's life, go look her up. Before Lena Horne, you heard Gwendolyn Brooks read five of her poems. And that about wraps it up for Word Temple tonight, folks. I hope to see you on Saturday, July 17th at 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts for the live Word Temple poetry series. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's program, I would love to hear from you. You can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks again to Philip Schultz and Hannah Maggiore, and thanks to you for listening.